You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, April 6, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, host of All In with Chris Hayes, Chris Hayes, on his book, A Colony in a Nation. Also on the program today, Bannon out. Generals now in control. And across Pennsylvania Avenue, Nunes out. And a different lunatic in control of the House Intelligence Committee. Meanwhile, Bill O'Reilly losing advertisers literally by the minute.
Factor.
And speaking at this moment, or just moments ago, Democrats filibuster Neil Gorsuch. And the Republicans vow to change Senate rules. I'm sure Mitch McConnell will be so sad about that. Meanwhile, Donald Trump may package infrastructure with tax cuts. Good luck with that, buddy. And the House Democrats invite Donald Trump to expand Social Security. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on today's program. Yes, indeed, everyone is in the House, even though Kelly had a fever yesterday. She's coming to work. I'm not making a big deal of it.
Why did you do that? I'll get sick. And then my shoes will fall off, and then my glasses, and then for the live show, my nose will be all runny. Hello?
As you can tell,
that's what he said.
Michael
yesterday
is here, and Matt is here with us.
Yeah, but he was like stomping around, though.
I was stomping around?
Yeah.
Well, you put your face on the pillow, which I had literally just taken a nap on moments earlier, right after saying, I've got a fever, and then you put your face on the
pillow. That is true.
I didn't know if we were allowed to take days.
What Kelly does is she says, I'm extremely ill and contagious, and now I'd like to touch everything in the office.
After you left yesterday.
Tired.
After you left yesterday, I
threw away the pillow? Nope, it's still there.
No, I wiped it down, though, with
the
Clorox stuff.
Are you kidding me?
All right, folks, let's get into this. Another incredibly jam-packed 24 hours of news. And Matt, just take a look at the YouTube I just sent you. That is a clip of Mitch McConnell bragging about his, in fact, let's go to we'll go to that. I mean, we have multiple major stories. As you know, yesterday, Bannon was, taken off the National Security Council. I think that's part of a much bigger story, frankly, but we will get to that, later in the program. This morning, Paul Ryan, the primary enabler of Donald Trump in this country, announced that Devin Nunes was going to be stepping aside from the House Intelligence Committee's Russia probe. Here is that statement he gave.
I just put a statement out probably while you were sitting here, so let me just tell you what my statement is. First of all, Devin Nunes has earned my trust over many years for his integrity and his dedication to the critical work that the intelligence community does to keep Americans safe. He continues to have that trust, and I know he is eager to demonstrate to the Ethics Committee that he has followed all proper guidelines and laws. In the meantime, it is clear that this process would be a distraction to the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian interference in our election. So Chairman Nunes has offered to step aside as the lead Republican on this particular probe, and I fully support his decision. Representative Mike Conaway a senior member of the committee, will now lead this investigation with respect to House Republicans on the Intelligence Committee. I'm confident that he will oversee a professional investigation into Russia's actions and follow the facts wherever they may lead.
And note that this is not just actually an investigation into Russian actions. You know, and with some justification, people have suggested that the Democrats have pushed this Russian hysteria about them controlling our election. But understand, the Republicans are doing this too, because they want to make it more about Russia than it is about the president and essentially the Trump organization. And make no mistake, that at the end of the day is going to be the part that is really relevant. Right? I mean, what are we going to do? Impose some brief sanctions on Russia because they put disinformation out about some campaign or leaked?
We might get more aggressive in our interference in their affairs.
Yeah, exactly.
More likely.
Yeah. We're going to double our budget we have for doing the exact same thing.
That's right.
No, the real issue here is, what did the Trump people do? And that's why they want to change the focus of this investigation. Comey was not saying that there was an ongoing investigation of Russia's interference with our election. It was an ongoing investigation about collusion between the Trump organization and campaign and Russians. So who is this guy Conway who's going to take over from Nunes? Now, Nunes is being investigated by the Office of Congressional Ethics because he may have revealed the existence of a FISA warrant. And also in terms of what he revealed to President Trump. As far as I can tell, no one still is even speculating as to, hey, is it possible that Nunes didn't just regurgitate to Trump what Trump's advisors already had? Is it possible that he just told him everything that Comey had just told him? For some reason, nobody brings that up. I don't understand why. But who is this Mike Conway? Well, I'll give you an example of who Mike Conway is. He is a Republican from Texas, Midland, Texas. That was actually, I think, where George Bush pretended to live for quite a while. And he had this to say to the Dallas Morning News this week about this idea that the Russians interfered with our election. Harry Reid and the Democrats brought in Mexican soap opera stars, singers, and entertainers who had immense influence in those communities into Las Vegas to entertain and get out the vote and so forth. Those are foreign actors, foreign people influencing the vote in Nevada. You don't hear the Democrats screaming and saying one word about that.
We need to...
Here is some footage of... I don't know if that's what he's referring to.
It's election hacking.
The Russians are hacking the votes, man, and the DNC emails. We need to send in our mariachi singers to counteract their influence and shore up Hillary, man. It's not going to just be enough to vote in New Hampshire.
Conway said that it worked really well in Nevada, as you see. Those folks are monster in the Hispanic community. They hold great sway. And I guess he was referring to Vicente Fernandez performing at a Hillary Clinton event. So, that guy should be, I'm sure, is going to be on the up and up on this. But the point being that, of course, they want to shift the conversation to that aspect of it, as opposed to, wait a second, what were the people in the Trump campaign doing? So, we'll see what happens.
Every Spanglish language star we need now, man. The Russians are on the move. Who's the girl from the show with the one where someone is dying from cancer, but they never die, and it's been going on for 7 seasons? We need her in Nevada now.
Is that...
hacking the elections.
I mean, who would have thought that the United States just a proxy in a huge Mexican-Russian war.
I say, that's the war, man. The fucking Russians got it this time, but we'll be coming back. Wait till we bring back the next Selena, man.
All right, let's briefly watch this clip from The View, which I must concede I don't generally watch. About
really?
Bill O'Reilly, there is becoming and maybe this is understated, frankly, because you had the head of the organization was a serial sexual assaulter. One of the stars of the organization of Fox Television, serial assaulter. He went on to become president of the United States. And the other sort of daily star also seems to be a serial sexual harasser. Of course, I'm talking about Bill O'Reilly. On The View Tuesday, co-host Sally Haynes asked former Fox News contributor Jediah Billa about working as Fox as a woman. This is what she had to say.
Of women and their dress codes. You guys have very specific dress codes, a certain length colored dresses, the way your hair has to be styled. That actually, for me, I haven't worked at a lot. I've only worked at two networks, but in my experience, I never have bumped into that at either network and what you're required to do at Fox.
Oh, what I was required. You get wardrobes, but it's different than here. You used to go into a room and there were a bunch of dresses that you could choose from. I was told at one point I wasn't allowed to wear orange because Roger didn't like the color orange. So I didn't wear orange. I didn't see any pants. People always say, why didn't you wear pants? You'll notice I wear pants a lot here. Mm-hmm. I didn't wear pants because I didn't see a pants option. I wasn't given a pants option, so I had to choose skirt.
Like, all fit in sort of a culture. Now that Trump is in the White House, Roger likes orange again.
Boom. There you go.
What a rotted organization.
Unbelievable. We got a clip. We'll play it later of Maxine Waters referring to Fox News as a sexual harassment enterprise.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fairly apropos. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, just a reminder, MR17, folks, MR Spring 17 for JustCoffee.coop. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Chris Hayes. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the New York Times bestselling author for now two different books and author of his most recent, A Colony in a Nation, Chris Hayes. Hello, Chris. Welcome back.
Sam, it's great to be here. You know, this week I was knocked down a peg by the debut of the Bill O'Reilly new book. He's got two. The new one is about traditional values against snowflakes. I just thought, like, that's so perfect. He published that book this week.
That is.
Make the subtext text about what this all means. Like,
is
his, so perfect.
What is his, does he have a subtitle on that? Is it something like My Life?
Old School, I think.
Yeah, I bet.
Exactly. It's like, it might as well be called, like, Good Old Boys or, like, you know.
My Life as a Madman. Yeah, that's pretty funny. Well, I'm sorry to hear that O'Reilly has knocked you out of the pole position there. But I mean, I've told you this before. I really enjoyed this book, and it's you know, congratulations on its well-deserved success. But let's start with the title. Because
yeah.
it came from, was it research you were doing on the book, or I mean, was it something that you had come across before?
I'd started to do research. Basically, I got an email from Tom Mayer, who's my editor at Norton, who'd written to my agent while watching me cover Baltimore, saying like, "Oh, has Chris ever thought about writing about this stuff in a book form?" And I was kind of like, "I don't think so. I'm not sure. It's not really my story to tell." And not sure what I can contribute. But I started sort of thinking about what I would do if I wrote about it. And I was, I thought, well, I should go back. I was really obsessed with the concept of Law and Order because to me, I feel like in Ferguson particularly, I'd sort of had this realization of how important the order part of that formulation is. And so I was like, oh, I should go back to sort of the original text of Law and Order, which is Nixon and particularly Nixon's 68 campaign. And I was reading the convention speech that he gave in Miami Beach where he has this line. It's sort of a throwaway line where he says, you know, black citizens, they want the same as white citizens. They don't want to be a colony in a nation. And that phrase just bowled me over because, first of all, it's basically what we constructed. But second of all, the other sort of theme that had been recurring through my head was just the degree to which police in the environments I was in and the interviews I was doing felt like occupying forces, felt like soldiers from a foreign army. And that phrase kind of catalyzed that in a way. And it sent me on this sort of interesting spiral back into our own colonial history and things like that.
And the irony is though, is that, Nixon was not talking about law and order at all, right? He was talking about sort of like welfare, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He was making a kind of, remember that Paul Ryan about like, we don't want this
the hammock, to
turn
right?
into a hammock, right? That was like, it was his own version of that, that like, you know, basically that African-Americans want, you know, they want an independent access to industry and wealth and on the great American dream. And they don't want to just be a colony. They don't want to be like sort of sitting there getting state aid. But, you know, it's Nixon that sort of pioneers the kind of rhetoric and policy that is what begins the process of constructing this massive machinery of policing and jails and prisons and incarceration.
Well, I mean, I want to circle back to that question. But if this really is a construct from Nixon, or if it's really just part of a continuum. Frankly, but before we get there, let's talk about how you use that phrase from Nixon, because you do sort of, I think you've just touched on it a little bit, but you specifically, which I also, I mean, I found really, and maybe the most fascinating part was those direct parallels that you make to America as a colony and the relationship between, you know, that analogy between the way what you saw in a place like Ferguson or in Baltimore and what America was in the 1760s and 70s or so. I mean, it just lay that out for us a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, what the sort of central thing I think to recognize that I didn't realize is that when we think about the revolution being about taxation and representation, that taxation is sort of a little bit misleading because we think of taxation, we think about our own tax system, right, which is like, you know, you file your forms or your payroll taxes and all this stuff. And none of that existed right at the time. All taxation was collected through customs enforcement, because that's how you tax stuff back then. That's how empires operated. They controlled their colonies and they sort of taxed all the trade through tariffs, and customs enforcers were the ones who enforced that. And because of these strict customs laws, the colonies were just a hotbed of smuggling. In fact, not just like smuggling as a kind of ancillary activity, but actually as the main economic activity. The distilleries that produce rum in the colonies, which was the sort of one of the central businesses of the colonies, ran on molasses that couldn't be imported from British Islands, were imported from Dutch Islands, and were all smuggled in. And, you know, John Hancock was one of the biggest smugglers. So smugglers had tremendous social capital, lots of money. They were these central figures. And what happens is after the England spends a lot of money in a 7 years war with the French, in the French Indian War, the new crown decides they're going to close the budget deficit by ratcheting up customs enforcement. And they crack down, and the crackdown is a, you know, it's a set of police actions. I mean, I call it the first stop and frisk era. You've got these general writs of assistance that mean customs officials can search anyone anywhere. They can break into your house. They can look into your possessions. They can pull over any boat. You've got Benjamin Franklin writing about how insane it is to use the Navy, which starts getting dragged into this enforcement action, to essentially militarize your police, to use the Navy to be dragging people. You've got John Adams talking about a central case in which a prominent lawyer fights against these writs of assistance, and Adams comes away saying everyone in that room came away with the spirit of revolution. Then and there, the spark of revolution was lit. And you've even got Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence itself, in a line I just didn't realize was there, complaining of the king. In the list of complaints, he has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. I mean, you know, that's Jeffersonese for fuck the police.
Right. And so, I mean, how does that, at one point you almost compare and contrast John Hancock with Garner. With Eric Garner in selling sort of the illicit cigarettes, but it's obviously their stature is very different. But that notion now bring that back forward in time.
Yeah, like the one way to think about the smuggling regime is to think about the drug war, right? So the state decrees some set of goods, you know, prohibited, and those goods still. There's still demand for them. They still enjoy a certain amount of, they're not totally socially taboo, right? People use them. And they have an economic black market that gets, you know, created around them. So in some ways, you can compare the smugglers to drug dealers. But, you know, Eric Garner wasn't a drug dealer. Eric Garner was just doing something that was almost directly parallel to what the smugglers were doing, which is that he was evading the tariff on cigarettes. I mean, you know, he was selling these Lucy's that were untaxed, and so evading the tariff on this good. And for doing that, he was confronted by the police and ultimately choked and killed. And there's just some horrible, tragic irony that this man, who says in the final monologue before he says, "I can't breathe," time and time again, he says, "Every time you see me, you want to come and harass me." And that's the word. That is exactly the word that Jefferson uses when he talks about the crown. He says, he sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance, make it impossible for them to make a living. And here's Eric Garner selling untaxed cigarettes, confronting the sentries of the state who are going to arrest him for exactly the thing that our founders engaged in and fought a revolution about.
And so, the other, I guess, use of that, there's not just the analogy in terms of the way that the police, but also the extraction, right? I mean, because the nation to a colony, you colonize basically to get resources, and that parallel also exists with Ferguson.
It absolutely does. I mean, Ferguson particularly, it's very clear that in the same way that the sort of Crown's policing was done for revenue, that's precisely what happens in Ferguson. In fact, in the DOJ report, where they have access to the emails of all the officials in Ferguson, they're incredibly frank about it. They talk about, like, getting up the new revenue pipeline, or, like, saying to the police chief, like, well, how many dollars do you think you can use to make up this budget deficit we have by basically enforcing, you know, pulling people over? So you've got in Ferguson, rather than raising property taxes or other taxes, a huge percentage of the revenue for the town comes from ticket revenue. And that ticket revenue is, is enforced by the police, who use their policing power to more or less prey upon and extract dollars from the predominantly black and brown passengers who are in cars.
And so, and then the I guess the other element of the colony in a nation is that one where you talk about the idea that this is a that there's almost an occupying force. I mean, that there's not, it's not just, I mean, I guess that maybe ties in with the police stuff, but and also this notion of white fear, which I think you talk about as almost like an inheritance in some way.
Yeah, I think that, I think that the sort of occupying nature of it is the fact that we have these agents of the state who are there to maintain order in neighborhoods, who by and large in almost every case are not from the neighborhood, right? Sometimes they are, but the sort of institutional memory and culture of the place is out external to it. They tend to view the places as, uncivilized hotbeds of illegality. I mean, you've got in Cleveland in a vehicle bay, the Department of Justice inspectors who are there see a sign calling that vehicle bay a forward operating base, which is, what the military uses to connote like a small camp deep in enemy territory in Afghanistan. You've got a Baltimore sergeant instructing his police before they go out for patrol to do not treat criminals like citizens, right? Like the whole point of the Constitution is that everyone gets treated like a citizen. Right. We all have constitutional protection. So you've got this mindset, James Baldwin writes in this essay I quote about the police walking through Harlem like a soldier in a foreign land. This mindset of this, you're in this foreign place and it's hostile towards you and you're there to kind of sublimate it and to subjugate it and to order it. And then driving this, driving the whole creation, driving Nixon's rhetoric and Donald Trump's rhetoric and Rudy Giuliani's rhetoric and, countless bits of rhetoric, through the years of this escalation is what I call white fear, which I say is this cultural inheritance that starts the day that the boat settling Jamestown comes ashore and the captain writes the first entry in his diary, like, we were set upon by the savages. And the experience of settlement, of the frontier, of the slave plantation for the white folks who are winning and conquering, even as they're winning and conquering, is one of this sort of paranoia and fear, right? Fear of the indigenous people, retaking their land, fear of slave rebellion. That idea that there's that the sort of order that the settler colonial folks have managed to impose on what they view as this sort of barbarous new world, that order is contingent and might be claimed back, taken back by the dark forces, and I use that term advisedly, outside the clearing. Like, that to me is like, that is central to our sort of inheritance as a nation.
I mean, is the fear just the flip side of the coin of like of the extraction? I mean, on some level, right? Like,
right, they're going to take it back. You mean?
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's not, well, we're taking something, so it's obviously like, we, and whether that was we're taking free labor, we're taking, we're taking the reduced labor. I mean, we're taking huge economic benefit. I mean, the country was completely built upon this. And, there's always a backlash. I mean, so like the fear is not, or it's not necessarily, it's maybe organic's the wrong word, but it is, the fear is sort of a second order issue, right? It's like,
yes, right. No, right. I mean, I sort of say that in the book, right? Like, it's almost morally perverse to talk about like the fear of the slaver.
Exactly.
That's not the fear we care about, like he's doing horrible things and the fear of, incomprehensible terror of being a slave. So it's not at all the morally salient attribute. And it's not even the most salient attribute in some ways to the exchange, right? I mean, like the slave owner is extracting huge amounts of value. I think is also in some cases, I think is sort of being transformed by the sadism and cruelty of the enterprise. But I think that as a descriptive matter of how we structure our thinking about particularly crime in this realm. It is just inescapably, its kernel is all in that, is in that sort of passed down experience of white fear.
I mean, on some level, right? It's a continuum. I mean, I guess I've just become more conscious of that continuum. I mean, there, you know, whether it's like Michelle Alexander, or I think it was Carol Anderson who wrote that book, White Rage, and where there is this almost rhythmic quality to American history, where when there's any measure of emancipation, there is almost, I don't know if it's, you know, how you calculate this, two steps forward, one and a half steps back, one step back, one half step back. But on some level, this is, I mean, is this dynamic a function of, is the carceral state that we see that you are in some ways describing, right? Both in terms of like small C and broader C, bigger C, I guess. Is that a, how distinct
how new
is it? How new is it and how distinct is it from, you know, is it a problem with policing or is it a problem with society that says we need the police to do this and we can't really quite admit that we need the police to do this?
Well, to answer the second question first, I mean, part of the argument in the book is it is a problem with society that like the police are agents of a lot of democratic decisions that have been made by us collectively as a people, as voters, particularly as a white majority in lots of places, and that's the place to look. So that I would say yes, like there's problems with policing qua policing from a sort of institutional and professional cultural standpoint, but there's a broader problem of what we've tasked them to do. The second question is a really important and interesting one, and one that I try to wrestle with a bit in the book, and I've been talking a lot in these book talks, which is there's sort of two things to keep in mind, right? There's the continuity you're talking about, which is, you know, it's crazy. You can go back and read accounts of police brutality in Harlem in 1919 and a riot that precipitated it, you know, the death of a young boy at the hands of police, and it's like nothing's changed. Like, it's unbelievable. Or you can read about the ways in which, you know, essentially slave patrols become law enforcement in the South. And so there is this just tremendous continuity. But there's also something distinct that it's important to kind of highlight, which is like the prison population of the country, the sort of magnitude of arrests, the construction of the world's largest criminal justice system, that's distinct and new starting around 1968. And going to now. I mean, you know, for all that continuity in the sort of subtext, the cultural impulses, the politics, the kind of white fear, like the actual system is new in the sense of that it's distinct. We don't have, you know, one fourth of the world's prisoners in 1950, and we do by 2011, right? So we do construct this huge thing. The number of arrests go up, the number of prosecutions, the number of people in jail, the number of people in prisons, the number of, you know, mandatory minimums and drug laws and enforcement dollars and seizure of, you know, forfeiture and SWAT teams and no-knock raids, and all of these things are a distinct phenomenon that sort of starts in the late 60s and extends through today.
And to what extent can you, I mean, what's the relationship between, in the event that we could dismantle, I mean, you know, just the past two or three days have two things in the news that sticks out for me that are, you know, sort of directly impact what you're talking about in your book. Obviously, Jeff Sessions basically saying, like, you know, to police forces around the country, don't worry. You know, shackles are off now. You guys go back doing whatever you do. In fact, we're giving you a future pass, which I can only imagine where that's going to lead. And then, obviously, the reversal on private prisons and, you know, everything has dramatically changed on that playing field, it seems to me. And the hopes we may have had for sort of conservatives and, you know, a transpartisan, trans-ideological criminal reform movement, I think, is sort of by the wayside. Also, though, in Ferguson, they just reelected its white Republican mayor for a third term.
Yeah.
By 15 points, and there does not, I mean, so let me ask you this. I mean, if
what's that about?
Right. Well, like, what's what that about? That? What is, I mean, what
well,
do you
here's,
do?
Here's, let me say this about, I don't know. I have not been doing enough reporting in Ferguson recently to give a good insight into that. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't want to. I haven't done the legwork to talk to voters there and give some explanation of what happened there. But I will say this, like, and I've been saying this on book tour, you know, we obviously are very focused on, you know, Sessions can do tremendous damage if he, you know, nullifies these consent decrees, if they don't do patterns and practices, if they don't provide oversight, he could do tremendous damages the way police departments operate. And the president can do a lot of bad things too. But one of the most important things to recognize is how locally this system was built. I mean, it really was, you know, there's thousands of different municipalities and interlocking jurisdictions. There's local elected prosecutors and city council mayors and council members and mayors of towns like James Knowles and state reps and state legislatures. And there's so many different entities that sort of constructed this system. And in some ways, that's hopeful for the following reason, that a lot of these people get elected in extremely low turnout elections, that if you are mobilized and committed to changing, you can. And we've seen some interesting organizing happening around prosecutor elections. There's one in Cook County. There was one in Orlando. Right now, Philadelphia is electing their prosecutor in a really interesting race. And in all those cases, like, if you're someone who's like, this matters to me, and you put in time and money and you volunteer and you organize, like, you can have a really huge impact leverage-wise just because those races are so, you know, they're so poorly sort of poorly paid attention to.
True. I guess my concern on some level is that people's awareness of that problem and ability to organize it are obviously diminished if there is no federal sort of, I guess, threat, essentially, right? On some level. And on another, I mean, I guess, you know, obviously I can't speak to Ferguson, but, you know, you got a 67% black population there. And presumably there are a lot of activists in that community.
It goes to show, I mean, it is a, what fires people up, what gets them to pay attention. I mean, that is a broader sort of alchemical equation that I'm, you know, you and I have actually talked about this because right. I mean, both of us are in positions to sort of really see in this weird way, right? These metrics of what is sort of getting people fired up.
It's hard to get people interested in this and motivated on some level.
Yeah.
And also, I think there's also probably huge swaths of people. I mean, again, I don't want to make presumptions about what's going on in Ferguson, but I imagine there's a lot of people who are feeling, and maybe we saw some of that in this past presidential election, that, like, you know what? Doesn't really make a difference. It doesn't. Right. It just this stuff is bigger than government, but in reality, I mean, in many respects, it is. But government starts to chip away at this, right? I mean, if by some way we could magically change the penal system in this country, it would, without any change in the sort of white supremacy, I guess, that undergirds a lot of this, right? I mean, because if we were, as white people, really upset about our police doing this stuff, we would have already acted upon it, right? Because, you know, none of this stuff would be tolerated. I mean, you write in the book, where you live in Brooklyn, none of this stuff would be tolerated there. None of it.
No. And certainly not. I mean, the other thought experiment I have in the book is, like, if you took this policing method to, like, any elite campus, like, people would lose their minds, right? Like, if, like, you know, like, I mean, what percentage of people walking around, like, a campus are carrying drugs at any moment. Like a non insignificant.
If they were stop and frisk on the campus of Brown University, I think there'd be a lot of like phone calls that would come in from
more than
parents,
phone calls, but, dude. Yeah, exactly. I guess you're sort of asking this hard question about like how you change the sort of deep structure of like sort of these white fear and pathology. Part of writing the book to me was just trying to get people to recognize when it's happening in them, when they're being appealed to in these terms. And I think it's really important to recognize how broad that appeal is. Like the appeal, you know, it's not just like the, you know, Trump voters in West Virginia. It's like, you know, white liberals elected Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, based on these same appeals. There's big parts of us that are receptive to it. We're conditioned to be receptive to it. And in some ways, I think sort of the first step is just recognizing when those receptors are being engaged.
Do you think those receptors, do you think it's just fear? I mean, or do you think it's, I mean, because you touch on the idea, and I should say that, I mean, I think, you start the book out with sort of, your a personal experience. You end on one, on that sort of, and throughout you drop in those moments, like when you're at the, was it the RNC? I think, was apparently trying to smuggle drugs into the RNC. You've written, not necessarily consciously, maybe I'm mischaracterizing.
Haplessly attempting to smuggle drugs in the RNC.
But it was turned out to be no issue, maybe a little embarrassing. Right. And of course, that is just ghastly different from the experience of a 16-year-old black kid living in the Bronx,
Right, or Davon Love, who lives in West Baltimore, who I talk about sort of having a kind of mirror experience in which he almost gets, busted for a robbery he did not commit, and only through sort of like being sort of quick on his feet enough does he manage to evade what could have been just a disastrous turn in his life.
But there's also this element of like, that it's tied into this idea of, in the nation element of it, like where we live in a place where there are good schools and there are good amenities and we want to live in a good neighborhood. And there's it's not just out of fear, right? I mean, there's
that's right. I mean, part of it is we want. We have sort of what we've done is we've sort of overlaid these different things such that like a good school and a good neighborhood mean these very specifically like racially loaded things in a way that they don't have to. Right. So like the desire to like send your kid to a good school is a genuine and universally held desire that because of the way that we've chosen to structure society means like sending them to a predominantly white school, right?
Right.
Like, and I think that part of the broader lesson here, and this is something I've really come to believe firmly. The broader lesson to me is just that it has a lot to do with what happens in the late 1960s on civil rights and civil rights enforcement, right? You get the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act. And you have school systems going through this very torturous process of desegregating, finding different ways of desegregating and being fought at every turn. And there's this sort of, you're from Worcester, so this I'm sure is sort of present in your cultural memory. There's the kind of like Waterloo of it all with the Boston busing fight.
Mm-hmm.
And what basically happens, post the 1970s particularly, is just as a society, we just give up on desegregation as an overarching policy goal. In 2017, if you say like, I am running on a platform of desegregation, people will be like, you're crazy. What are you talking about? But that project was never completed at all.
No, in fact, it's gone. It's gone worse, I think.
Yeah, it's gotten worse. And it's just like, we had this project called desegregation in which, and it was a brutal fight at every square inch, fought against. And eventually like the forces that were fighting it kind of won. I mean, and they won in all sorts of ways. I mean, the Supreme Court, you know, through a series of cases, particularly Parents Involved, which is a monstrous case, you know, basically makes it impossible to desegregate schools. There's, you know, the enforcement, the sort of, and then, you know, there's an inertial quality to it, which is that once places the sort of, once lines get drawn and school districts are school districts, then it's like everyone is just in their place. And like, we've allowed all those borders and lines to harden. And we don't have anyone really at any level, like, talking about that as unacceptable and something that we should undo.
I mean, it seems to me like that soft segregation, right, that we do now, right? It's not institutionally imposed, and right. but it's we've just organized things in a way to sort of take care of itself in some ways,
right,
is like analogous to that, this dynamic of a colony nation, that is maybe they're basically very similar structures, if not the same structure. It's just on one end of that is the tip of the spear being the policing, and the other end of that is just sort of like a general sorting, right? Like there's this metaphorical, you know, ocean that we're the nation, and then we send ships to the colony.
Right, that's right, and that's exactly right. And in some ways, like it's the distance of the inner life we've allowed to grow up between these sort of two regimes that also makes confronting it difficult, right? Because like it's sort of this out of sight, out of mind situation, and that's particularly true of New York circa 2017 in a way it wasn't of New York circa 1997,
right?
When, because of the much higher crime rate and because of the way the city sort of imposed itself on you, it was harder to just sort of like retreat into like a little like placid, placid little corner of the nation. Right. But that's what we've constructed. And I mean, obviously this connects to other broader themes in, you know, the work I've done. And in my first book of like, it's just another way in which like the sort of trajectory of American life is towards this sort of like balkanization, particularly along kind of race and class lines, where it's like there are these, you know, these small precincts that are, you know, it looks like a society that's not a middle class society. I mean that's the shortest way to say it, but you know, places of sort of protection, privilege, stability, thriving, and then, you know, huge places of you know, struggle.
Let me ask you a meta question, because I, you know, Twilights of the Elite was very, prescient or just, you know, sort of aware of what was going on at that time. Right. I mean, we have really, we've reached it. I wonder if when you were writing this book, I mean, did you, you know, contextually, I assume that you were assuming Clinton was going to win, and these type of questions, I mean, obviously the book has done quite well, but these type of questions would, I think, under a Clinton administration, have attained a much higher status or much more...
They would be much more central in the, like, national domestic political agenda.
Yeah, indeed, right? Because right? Exactly. And, I mean,
yeah,
how much...
Yeah, because they would be, you know, there would be legislative movement on some, you know, criminal justice and policing reform. That would be a thing that, you know, something she ran on and something that, you know, they would be working on, I think.
And there would, and there would be a lot of people, I mean, I think, like, particularly the campaign would set up, you know, and you know, the BLM folks, and just there was a lot of the dynamic would have thrown these questions into a more central, I think, equation. So, like, just tell me your thoughts on that, you know, because you write this book, and I don't imagine when you wrote Twilight of the Elites that you anticipated, like, you know, because it was not the topics in that book were not as sort of like who was president was not as much of an issue, right? I mean, it's I think on some level.
Yeah, although I think, you know, in one way, I think that's true from the domestic political agenda. But I think that, like, to me, the book is sort of more resonant now as a sort of
what's going on in the world.
Well, what's going on in the world and the sort of mapping of the mind of sort of Trump's appeal, right?
Right. I mean, yes.
You know, I mean, I've come to realize that, like, part of what made Trump, you know, Trump's entire worldview is formed by being in New York in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it's a worldview of that combines two things. One is, like, the experience of social crisis unraveling material decline. Things are getting worse. Things are going to hell in a handbasket. And that it's being done at the hands of some, you know, other.
Right. Just watch Warriors, right? It's Warriors, right?
Yeah, I mean, you remember? It is Warriors. I think his worldview, which is very much like, that's his worldview. That is, like, authentic. Like, I don't think there's always this question of, like, how much is he demagoguing and playing to his crowd and how much is he, but that part of the worldview is authentic. And even though I thought of that experience of New York during those years as distinct, it turns out that those elemental experiences, decline plus blame for said decline on some other, is endlessly exportable to all sorts of corners of the country.
Indeed. Oh, of course.
You know, from Mahoning County to Erie County to McDowell County, West Virginia. Like, and nowhere is this more present to me than in the border rhetoric, because the border is his version of broken windows. Like, the idea of broken windows of, like, this, like, neurotic sense that, like, there's disorder and unraveling and it needs to be, like, staunched, right? And when you think about the border, it's like, why does the border wall have such outsized, you know, symbolic potency in the Trump canon? Particularly when you think, like, why does anyone in West Virginia care about the border?
Right.
What's it to you? they're not coming to, you know, coming to you. Like, and if they do, like, you know, the people are going to come maybe get a job somewhere, but the reason is because the border represents, you know, almost in, like, an overly literal way, right? Like, it represents that lack of order. It represents the sort of, like, incursion and the source of white fear and all the sort of stuff I talk about in the book, that kind of sense of contingency. They're going to take that land back. They're going to take it back. And the potency of that, I mean, nothing illustrates the potency, the continued potency, and the almost, like, endlessly universal potency of it than his election.
And really, I mean, the two different types of policing that you talk about in the colony and the nation, right? I mean, it was perfectly mirrored almost in the campaign on some level, where he's talking about, you know, policing as maintaining order and as opposed to the concept in the nation, which is, like, serve and protect.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
All right. Listen, I have you. I got to ask you just a couple of questions about the news. And I know people are
going
to go.
Is there anything going on? I'm just looking at my phone. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Looks like some things happened.
I got one thing that I keep wondering why nobody brings up. Well, there's no speculation. I want to know if you've heard anything about this. Obviously, like, you know. With Nunes, why has the focus been exclusively on, okay, the idea that the idea that they were trying to whitewash this intel to bring it back to Trump, you know, right, to make this case that he had been wiretapped? Why does the fact that the timing of him going to the White House, literally hours after the first time he's been briefed by Comey in private as to what the status of the investigation is and who they might be following and whatnot, why has not the most obvious explanation come up that Nunes was going to tell Trump what they got?
Right. I don't know. That's a great point. I'm glad you connected that dot.
I mean, so I understand. It was the most obvious thing in the world. And wait, Nunes
The timeline is Comey gives them he gives him a classified briefing.
For the first time, right? The public briefing was the first time. Prior to that, we had just seen that he wouldn't acknowledge the existence of this investigation to any of the congressional leaders,
right?
Until Sessions is recused. Then he goes and he gives a public testimony. Then he gives private testimony. And then Nunes.
Right.
I mean, there's a reason why he's not sharing this this stuff, because I'm not, I mean, maybe it exists, but Nunes knows he can't get to the White, like, how else would he get word to the White House about exactly what he heard in there?
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe this is just sort of off the wall, but I mean, it seems to me the most obvious thing. That's the most value that Nunes has to those people. Not that he can be, because they could have leaked this stuff to anybody.
Right. Right. Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a great point. I mean, I find myself, like, Nunes is a character who's a little like Carter Page, where it's like, I don't know what to make of them. Like, I'm having a hard time mentally modeling their motivations.
Well, that's the thing, I feel like Nunes was making it all up after the fact.
Bumbling. Like, so bumbling. And so, it's just like, how did this guy get into this position? I just, every time I see him, I'm just like, how did you end up here?
Well, isn't that really the whole story about all of it? I mean, at this point, like, you know, the healthcare debacle, I mean, it was, you know, how did Paul Ryan, like, all of these people are just, it's empty suits. I mean, Mitch McConnell seems to be the only one who knows what he's doing in the entire thing.
Oh, yeah. McConnell's many things, but what he is not is an empty suit. Like, McConnell 100% knows what he's doing.
I'm just, you know, there are moments like that where I think it's just sort of stunning. I mean, give me your sense of the relative import to the idea of Russian interference versus the relationship that Trump and the Trump organization pre and post election had with malefactors. I mean, I guess, I mean,
I don't know. Like, I just feel like I really want to get to the bottom of it. I don't have some sort of theory underneath it. Like, I you know, there are people I know who do, right? There are people I know who have sort of are working on a sort of theoretical architecture they've constructed around the facts we know that make predictions about things we will learn. Like a kind of theory of the case. I don't have a theory of the case, and a part of me just thinks, like, so much of this was so obvious. And in public, I'm not clear why you would even need collusion, because, like, the Russians break in to the DNC. It clearly, you know, people forget that hack, how, you know, important it was. Like, you know, I was in Philadelphia when, like, the Bernie folks were, like, screamingly booing the entire first day, any mention of Hillary Clinton. And that was because the day before had been the release of the emails.
Right.
And keep in mind, like, there were, like, actual, like, Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to go fly home and not be the chair of the DNC. Now, she was in trouble for a million reasons before those emails, but those emails, Donna Brazile, replaced her and then lost her position as a CNN commentator. Like, those had real effects. Then, you know, it becomes pretty clear early on the Russians did that, right?
Now, so, I mean, how do we know that, though? I mean, do we know that just because we've been told? I mean, like, when we say Russians, I mean, because I'm just convinced it's just like just some guy, you know, there's a fluidity as to who all these people are.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
That's true. And also, I mean, you
like,
know,
is Felix Sater, is he a Russian spy? Maybe sometimes.
I have no idea.
Maybe sometimes not.
Like, I don't know what. Yes, exactly. And like you're right to sort of zero in on like the Russians as like this overly broad category. But I think like state-backed Russian actors, I think that this particularly the sort of DC leaks and the Guccifer part of it, like, you know, there it ties it all pretty clearly. And so, you know, that happens, and then it's like Trump is like super pro Putin. Very publicly, right? And then they also help him in October. So it's like that, like all that stuff happens in public with public knowledge. I mean, Donald Trump looks into a camera and tells Russia to hack Hillary Clinton. Like, why would you need some sort of
back
fancy
channel.
Back channel?
Yeah, I think that's just, I think there's just like, I think so much of what we see is coincidence. None of which
Can I read you a great headline? This is just crossing over right now. This is the Daily Beast. Steve Bannon calls Jared Kushner a cuck and globalist behind his back.
Oh, my God. It's well, all right. So that was the other thing I wanted to talk about. But let me just finish the thought about Russia.
It's not an Onion article. I love it.
I mean, is there any doubt that Kushner is a cuck? I mean, come on.
I mean, right.
I mean,
listen, for all of us to see.
I think there's probably just a lot of coincidence. I'm quite convinced that at the end of this, it's going to be like they're in the White House going like, all we did was pal around with a bunch of Russian mafia guys, did some money laundering, and they accuse us of being spies. Like it's like,
yes, exactly.
It's going to be like one of those things like where you rob a bank, but you end up getting a ticket for speeding. And
absolutely,
or vice versa.
But I also think, like again, like Lord knows what's in that guy's business dealings and tax return. I mean, so it seems both the spectrum of possibilities from like, yeah, there was no collusion, it was all just like this sort of tacit quid pro quo in public, to like, you know, yes, everything in the dossier is real. Like everything in between those seem completely plausible.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
I agree. All right. Well, let me just ask you about that last headline. Are we watching sort of the generals seem to have taken over, right? They take Kushner to Iraq. Then Roger Stone 2 days ago is talking on InfoWars about how Kushner is stabbing Bannon in the back. And then Bannon's out from the NSC. I mean, is it McMaster's or is it really Mattis in Iraq basically working on Kushner? And he's, you know, Mattis is like, call your dad. Tell him that Bannon's got to be out. This stuff is serious. We can help out your dad's presidency, but Bannon has got to go.
What is shaping up in the flurry of leaks, and God, the way this place leaks, is that... that, you know, there's this kind of Bannon Kushner showdown and power struggle happening. And I think the generals are probably on Kushner's side, as signaled by that Iraq trip. And also, like, keep in mind, you know, we reported on my show and it was an exclusive, you know, I got a source saying this, that like, remember the guy before McMaster was Harward.
Right.
And Harward was recruited heavily for the job and basically was like, I need to know that I'm not working for Steve Bannon. I can go directly to the President of the United States. And that was the concern, that ultimately, like, he could not be assured of that. He didn't take the job. Well, lo and behold, then fast forward, McMaster takes the job. McMaster, by the way, who's still active duty, right?
Right. So he couldn't technically say no, right? Right.
It's very hard for him to say no, right? McMaster takes a job and wants to get rid of Ezra Cohen Watnick, who is a person Flynn brought into the NSC staff on intelligence. Cohen Watnick goes to, the reporting says, Kushner and Bannon, and then to the president directly to save his job, which he does. Now, he's the guy that's showing Nunes the intel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is just an unbelievable breach, right? To go over the national security advisor's head. I think that showed that like Harward's concerns were exactly right. Now McMaster somehow engineers a kind of revenge, right? Which is that gets Bannon kicked off the principal's committee, gets Coates and Joint Chiefs back on, those two who had been on the sort of standing permanent principal's committee under Obama. And I think is clearly sort of having his revenge on Bannon. And I mean, the spin yesterday was so hilarious.
There's a story that where Bannon is talking about, like, I'm ready for a gunfight. Has there ever been a time where like people, like major players in the administration, are openly talking about hostilities in the White House?
David Gergen said that in the Clinton administration.
Wait, is that I mean, that seems insane to me, right?
Gergen also went around calling everyone a cuck.
Right, he was famously a cuck caller.
Surrounded by cucks, that was his memoir, actually.
But is Bannon just basically getting ready to exit and, you know, making and just, you know, sort of Breitbartizing this whole thing, or what?
I mean, I wonder, because God, Lord knows, like, both sides are leaking like crazy. I mean, I'm reading this Daily Beast piece here, and, like, there's a, you know, then there's, the people that were the people that were shivving Bannon with the leaks about how he threatened to leave. I mean, that place is just, what a snake pit. It's just unbelievable. I mean,
hopefully the generals will come in and just calm everybody down, and we'll just have this sort of this is like a soft military coup where they keep Trump.
Well, you worry about that, right? Because that's clearly like Trump who, the guy doesn't know anything. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't. I mean, the other thing is, the hilarious thing is, the battle between Bannon and Kushner is a battle of ideology. Kushner, a lifelong Democrat and liberal. Bannon, a nationalist. It's this was evident from the beginning that the guy doesn't have a belief system.
Right, that Trump does it. That there's no... Yes. And I don't... does Kushner
Of course
really...
there's going to be a high-stakes... There's a high-stakes battle for, the vessel...
I mean, do you think Kushner does either? I just get the sense that he and Ivanka are just like, this is, it's cutting down on our social circle a little bit. And, there's a picture of Kushner in Iraq wearing his blue blazer with a flak jacket over it.
With a flak jacket that says
Kush. Over it.
Yeah.
And all I'm thinking is, this guy's now... For the first time, surrounded by these military guys who it probably took them 3 days before Kushner was just like, I'm totally on board with that. Completely just
you guys are amazing.
Overwhelmed. I'm going to tell Dad exactly, right? We get rid of Bannon. What else should we do? And that's it. And, I don't know. It gets a little worrisome that you're worrying that the most reasonable guys in the room are the guys probably at the very least there's some question about atrocities and they've been
I don't think there's question. It's definitely the case.
That's a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's really nerve-wracking. I mean, we sat in my office yesterday and we watched him do his press avail with the King of Jordan. By the way, be like, which one of these is the native speaker of English as the first language between these two? You can always see with him, when he's out past what he knows, which is often.
Right.
The only place where he was, sure-footed was when he's blaming Obama. The Iran deal was terrible. He gets a question about Iranian militias in Syria and Hezbollah, and it's just, nothing. There's no... nothing. And it's just, it was just terrifying to watch. I found that plummeting quality of the stomach of this guy's out there. He has no idea what he's talking about. He's kind of freelancing these answers. You'll see. And, it's a big situation. And the barstool gas bag. But it's that guy, if he wanted to, could go back into the White House and pick up a phone and be like, we're airstrikes in Syria. He could do that.
Right.
It's terrifying.
The only, I think, upside of him being so obviously out of his depth is that I get the sense that the rest of the world is just like, we don't really have to be too confused about what's going on because the answer is always the guy just doesn't have a clue as to what he's doing.
That is, it's so funny you said that because we were debating this in the office yesterday and I think we all came to the conclusion that, a normal president would be seen as making policy by things he says.
Right.
But that is not the case here because everyone understands that he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Everyone just
chalk it up.
It mitigates it that he's internationally known as a total clown. And he's less dangerous because of that, which is amazing. It's there are some things that are so bad they're good, and this is worse. And people are just, Chris Hayes, I'll let you get back to work. I know you may have some news to talk about tonight.
And you got some stuff that's coming in here on the old smartphone.
There's still a couple hours left in the day, so who knows?
Well, I'm definitely leaving. Ned Reznikoff, who used to work for me, was a Think Progress Now. It was just imagine being a 63-year-old man who unironically calls people cucks. I mean, who are these people that are running the country? Who are they?
Terrifying.
My God. Okay.
A Colony in a Nation. Thanks so much.
Yeah, the book. Yeah. Go buy some books.
People
all right?
will buy this book. We'll see you later. Thanks, Chris.
All right. All right, see bye. You, man.
There you have it.
Still not taking responsibility for what he's done.
No. Oh, you didn't. We didn't have a chance to do.
Then you got fucking Chris Hayes.
Well, we've got a lot of cuck talk to talk about in the...
Well, I mean, he said, who can imagine a 64-year-old man saying that? And I would say, certainly not you, you cuck. You can't put yourself in the gorilla mindset, Chris.
That's right.
You look like a freaking lesbian. What would you know?
Can't get the... the cuck.
And it is a cuck. It is true.
All right. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You've heard about the YouTube apocalypse. What are they calling it now? Are they calling it anything like that?
Well, no one's calling it what you just said. Well, but if you wanted to call it that, I guess it would be the YouTube apocalypse.
Well,
apocalypse.
That's why our for the most part, we do what I consider to be a radio show here. But it is our members that provide the vast revenue for us. So if you have the financial means, join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you a ton of extra content afterwards. And these days, God, man, there's not enough time. There's not enough time. Also, MR Spring 17, 30% off Just Coffee. MR Spring 17, 30% off Just Coffee. You can finally try the Majority Report blend. See which coffee you could try. Or if you've been trying the Majority Report blend, you're like, I wonder what that Los Diosos tastes like, or the bike fuel, or whatever it is. And you're like, but I don't want to pay full price to test it out. Now's the time to do it. 30% off for the month of April, MR Spring 17, justcoffee.coop. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon or jet.com, do so through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on those respective links. Buy your stuff through those links. You will notice absolutely no difference whatsoever. But we get a little kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back. He says no, 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 no. And though